Welcome to the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
I am chef owner of several Seattle restaurant institutions, although most of them are closed to me.
But that's where the institutions.
But we still have our serious takeout out at 52nd and 14th Avenue Northwest, where you can get serious pie and all of our dinner boxes. We've got serious pie downtown open. Seatown, which I did a oyster bar at this last weekend. Super fun. I was out shucking oysters for 6 hours. Oof. On the patio on Saturday. It was really fun. Raul from Pencove Shellfish joined me. It was a blast. As a matter of fact, it was so much fun, I'm going to do it every Saturday. I'm going to try every Saturday.
Wow.
At least for 4 hours out there. And so I'll be out there this Saturday. Come say hi.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And I just have one more thing.
Sure.
We're coming to you from the Hot Stove Society, which is open for virtual classes. So
that's right.
That's the businesses we have open right now, along with Rub With Love.
And you find all this information at TomDouglas.com. That's easy.
You betcha.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, and I have Luke in Madison Valley, which is now open, obviously, for dinner every Wednesday through Saturday. And we also have takeouts and... that's about the extension of that. So come on down and see us and say hi, and, you know, we'd gladly cook you dinner.
Any thoughts on when Lule might reopen?
No. So Lule downtown is, downtown with Amazon announcing that they're going to push it back to July for the offices to be coming back. So that's going to be, we have no idea yet.
Yeah, it's going to take its toll.
I encourage anybody to... petition to reopen downtown.
We're going to talk crab this hour with our continuation of Seafood 101. We'll take your a couple of cooking questions that we've had asked on Facebook that our producer Madeline has lined up for us. Check in with Jessica Hathaway, the editor-in-chief of National Fisherman Magazine. Amy's back for everyone's favorite. Why is it favorite when everyone... when it's Torture Tom and Terry, why is that everyone's favorite? I don't know. Everyone. I think it's Maddie, and I think it's Amy's favorite. I don't think it's everyone's favorite. Finally, we're going to wrap up the show today at the end of our second hour with our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge brought to you by Rub With Love Spice Rubs, my very own spice rub line and of sauces and rubs and mustards and all
and
that
very
sort of
world
thing.
Famous.
Terry, I don't know if you can see what's in front of us, but Keyport. 100% natural and wild-caught crab, Baird-Eye crab, is right there in front of us.
I am very excited about that.
And in about 10 minutes, we are going to be chowing on a little crab. Happy.
That's
happy
a good breakfast.
That. Yeah, exactly. Favorite taste of the week? You've been traveling.
I was in a town called Texarkana this week.
Is that a town or an area?
It's actually a town.
It's a town,
It's a town that's split in the middle by Texas and Arkansas. Well, I must say, and it was hard to find a green vegetable wherever I had. I went to the same place 3 days in a row for breakfast, the Cracker Barrel. The only other place I went to was the Waffle House. They were not that great. The waffle was not that great. And that was, to me, I was going there for that because I was like, oh man. And it was, you know, dinner time. So we went to the Waffle House for dinner time after going to someone's house. And my brother-in-law was getting married. Congratulations, by the way, Johnny and Caroline. And, you know, we went, we had some poo-poos at their house, and then we, on the way home to Texarkana, which is about 40 minutes away, my son Adrian and I were like, well, you know, we could use a little something to eat, and he was excited about the Waffle House, so we went there. It is definitely a slice of America, and I wanted to try it. I've never been to a Waffle House, trying the Waffle House, and I was a little bit disappointed about the waffle. They were not quite as good as I wanted them to be.
Well, enough about your Arcana trips, because it didn't sound like you had that much deliciousness. I'm going to tell you what I made.
Okay.
I made the classic rookie mistake.
Uh-oh.
I know. Can you imagine what that would be? What would
too much lemon, too much cream, too much
There's
salt.
No cream, and there was no lemon.
Well, I'm just saying, rookie mistake would be.
So what I did was, my favorite COVID meal I get from Thai Siam restaurants, it's turned out to be my favorite, right?
Right.
It's like the most consistent meal that I've had in the last 7 months. Maybe once a month I stop for salmon in the Red Sea, which is like a red curry coconut sauce salmon. And one of my favorite things about the Thai Siam is that they use wild salmon.
Yeah.
It's hard to find in many restaurants because it's expensive and... But I love it that they use wild salmon there. That's perfect. So I go to recreate it. I'm just kind of in the mood for it. Jackie's back from the farm. I'm going to make this little curry that I've been enjoying while she's at the farm. It's like one of my dinners. And I do it. I get a can of coconut milk. I have my Mei Ploy red curry paste in the fridge. pull that out. You know, you can't use too much because it's spicy
stuff. Sure, sure.
So I'm about a 2-star guy. And then I, you know, when you get it at Thai Siam, it's got sautéed spinach and onions and green peppers and red peppers and Thai basil and but a nice brothy kind of red sea sauce. So what did I do?
So what is the mistake you made?
And I'm doing all the pieces and I'm tasting it as I'm going and I add a little more paste because I want a little more spicy. And but then I add my onions and my peppers and my spinach and blah 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 blah. I have this beautiful salmon that I bought at Maddie. What was the name of that fish store? Fresh Fish Co. up at 80th and 24th up in North Ballard. Beautiful wild king salmon. Cooked it perfectly. Put it in the bottom of my bowl with the genmai brown rice, that really fragrant brown rice.
Is the rice underneath or where is the rice?
Yeah, it's in the bottom of the bowl. It's delicious. It's perfect. It's beautiful, fragrant rice. Salmon cooked perfectly. And then I pour my curry over the top, and it's just this big blob of stuff that ruins the look of the dish.
You can't even see the salmon.
And it's a rookie mistake, right? How many times have I said, if some is good, that doesn't make more better,
no.
Right? And I did that classic thing where I had too much other stuff on top of, where's my fish? Where's my beautiful rice? It's buried under this all this mound of stuff. I take it to the table kind of sheepishly. We kind of pick at it. And I mean, it was good, but it wasn't. It was just, you know, you eat with your eyes.
Of course,
right?
First, yes.
First. I mean, I was mad at myself. What a rookie error. Even if I had just made the one change of putting the salmon on top, instead of the salmon on the bottom, underneath all that goop.
By the way, that dish sounds delicious.
It is delicious. I didn't do it justice. But I won't make the same mistake again next time, I can tell you that.
You remember that, Paul.
You know, Chef, we have a bunch of crab sitting in front of us, bear-eye crab.
Right.
And we're going to continue our Seafood 101 through this month of October. And we're going to have Will Wilding, Will Whiting, captain and owner of Aleutian Beauty, and Jamie Gohn, executive director of Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers, here to chat with us next on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Tom Douglas and the chef in the chapeau who's got a mouthful of bear-eye crab.
Man, that is good. Yeah, for breakfast like that? I haven't had anything to eat yet. This is delicious.
Really?
Sweet.
Sweet. Mm. Tastes like crab, oddly.
Sweet and nice sea flavor.
October is October is National Seafood Month, and to celebrate, local fishing organizations, the Port of Seattle, and the Seattle Propeller Club have joined together through a Seafood 101 campaign. Long story short, Terry, they want us to eat more Alaska seafood.
You know what? I'm all in.
So we invited Bill Whiting here and Jamie Gohn, and also thanks to Keyport Seafoods, the 100% natural and wild-caught bear-eyed crab is on our plate. And let's start with Jamie real quick, since we're taking a bite of this. What did you do with this morning? It is so good. Probably nothing is my guess.
Yeah, that's the beauty of bear-eyed crab. So it's already cooked. And so all you have to do is thaw it out, bring it out of the fridge after about a day of thawing, and you can eat it straight like that. If you prefer, you can warm it up too. But it's a great, simple meal and delicious.
And the most important thing you said there was put it in the fridge and let it thaw in the fridge. Do not put it under running water, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, that's a last resort. As a matter of fact, I'd rather cook it from frozen than put it under running water and wash away all that good crab.
Yeah, because you get rid of all that flavor.
Well, thank you for bringing that. Thank you for getting up early to shuck this crab.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you use a scissors or a hammer?
I use a little bit of both. And then I find bear eye is easy. You can snap it right in the middle of the section, so it's really easy to pick.
So bear eye, you said, is the cousin of the snow crab.
Yeah, it's the larger cousin of snow crab, and it tends to be the fisherman's favorite of the crab, even more so than king crab.
And why would that be?
It's a sweeter meat, just the texture and sweeter meat.
Cool. All right, Bill Whiting, over at the other microphone. He is the captain and owner of FV Aleutian Beauty, and apparently a pretty good Norwegian cook.
Thank you, Tom. But I'm not Norwegian.
I know, that's what I'm saying.
With my German background, I learned how to boil codfish well.
Yeah, I'm sure. Tell us about what you do, sir.
Well, I'm a fisherman that still fishes after 40-plus years in the Bering Sea. The Aleutian Beauty is my last of my vessels. I just got home. I was fishing actually longline, but I'm here today representing the crabbers because that's where I started. So 40 years ago, I left Ballard as a young man and got a chance to go work on deck with all those Norwegians, as they said.
And got your chops. And what's the big difference between crabbing and, say, longline fishing? Is it different areas of the Bering Sea? I obviously know one's crab and one's a crab pot, and the other is a long line, like a fishing line.
Well, typically we fish these crab that you're familiar with, snow, barredeye, and king crab, in the flats of the Bering Sea, usually 300 feet of water thereabouts, give or take 100 feet or so. And they are fished with pots. And the crab, they run in streaks or schools or higher areas of density, and these pots are baited, and they're very very specific to the species of crab, and they also have escape there, so we are handling a small crab is very minimal, so it's a very clean fishery. Hooks, on the other hand, are fished with one at a time, as you had Scott Hansen on the other day fishing his codfish with the factory longliners. Those again are very specific targets in clean fisheries. Very little environmental damage to the bottom. And with black cod, we're fishing out to several thousand feet of water, and with halibut, all the way up as shallow as 100 feet of water, depending on the time of year. And that's what I do currently today with the Aleutian Beauty.
I like how he says one at a time.
I know.
A long line could be like 5 miles long with a hook every 12 inches?
4 feet for me.
Every 4 feet?
We're stuck at 4 feet, and yes, they are 5 mile long strings.
I love that. One at a time. How has this year's fishing season been?
Well, I just got back from a St. Matthews trip, and it was quite well. The fish were in the shallows. As I tell everybody, they came up like angry bucking broncos when you bring them up out of the shallows. Big, beautiful halibut that can weigh in excess of 100 pounds.
Yeah. How are you feeling about climate change and what it's doing to the crabbing up in the Bering Sea?
That's a difficult thing. As I've been involved now 40 years in the fishery, do we see impacts? Yes. But what's the future hold? Do any of us know? The bottom temperatures seem to be good. I mean, our early reports on this king crab fishery that's going on as we speak is that they're catching and seeing a lot of crab, even in a very diminished season that we have this year. So I can't really specify one way or the other whether I'm seeing a doomsday scenario, or I'm seeing some benefits.
Maybe the temperature have not reached that deep yet.
No.
The rising of the temperature maybe
but
not.
In our summer surveys, we do check bottom temperature. And that bottom temperature can vary year to year. But the science, again, back on what it does to the actual crab stocks with the larvae that come up into the top surfaces of the water, the predation from the pollock species and various other fish species, and then as it returns to the bottom and its survival rate, I mean, it's just so much unknown. I mean, we continue to push for good science so we are good stewards of our fisheries.
Right. And is this acidification is an issue up there like it is here, like just in our Hood Canal and places like that, where you don't get the change of tide as much?
Well, acidification is more of an acid level, isn't
right,
it? The pH
right.
in the water column itself. I have not heard of any increases at all or read any studies in the Bering Sea or the Aleutian Islands where I fish my black cod.
All right. Cool.
Good.
Let's talk about, between you and Jamie, let's talk about the best ways to cook this. Now, this is also called, if I'm not mistaken, Ophelia crab, right?
Yeah, actually, Ophelia is a different species. This is Chionides barredeye, and then there's Chionides Ophelia as well, but they can actually interbreed too and create a hybrid crab. So it's a cousin to snow crab, which is also called Ophelia,
but this
is technically barredeye.
So this is probably your favorite way. It's just a thought and pick it. Is there a way that you like to cook it, like a frittata or, you know, any sort of way, or just cocktail, or how do you like
in
to cook?
Salads?
Yeah, well, so I love to serve this to my family because it's a super easy meal to just thaw and put the legs on the table and the kids can have fun getting into them. And then if there's any leftover crab, I'll take that the next day and put it into mac and cheese. That's my favorite way.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah.
He just got Maddie's attention. Yeah.
And what kind of sauce do you use when you're using it cold? When your kids are breaking down the legs?
I just do a garlic, lemon, and butter.
And oh, nice.
Little thing right
next
to it. You
can dip it in there.
Dip
yeah,
it in.
Good.
Just
yeah.
dip it on in.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds delicious.
I'm just thinking about how often I have just sat down to a big plate of crab and thought it was like, it was my lucky day on earth.
Oh, yeah.
To have that sitting in front of me.
You're blessed if you have a beautiful piece of crab like this in front of you. I mean, that's exactly. not common, so.
Bill, you're a cook. Tell me how you like to cook this crab, this Baird-eye crab.
Well, you said it earlier. Keep it simple. Keep it simple. Mm-hmm. And I like a Caesar salad. So to make a good Caesar dressing, muddle those anchovies and that garlic and that good olive oil.
Umami, yeah.
My wife, she does the most awesome croutons that you could ask for, that she does slowly in butter and lots of garlic.
You obviously haven't had Tom's world-famous croutons.
It sounds the same. It sounds like it is. Yeah.
From leftover great bread from Grand Central Bakery. Are we as lucky as can be in Seattle to have a
absolutely.
Bakery of that quality?
Several.
Yeah, well, there's others too, but that one's readily available.
Yeah.
And, you know, just a great fresh garden salad and loaded on top with crab.
Mm.
And
so,
Baird-eye crab is definitely the favorite.
So the number one thing to remember if you're buying this at home from the grocery store or fish shop or fish market, whatever, is to try and thaw it naturally. It almost always comes frozen. Try and thaw it naturally in the fridge, so at least a day before. These are smaller than king crabs, so they'll thaw more easily. And then if you're going to heat it up, don't take it over 105 degrees. Because as soon as you start taking it up hotter than that, all the moisture wants to bleed out. You end up with a bunch of stringy crab and nothing luscious.
Right. You're trying
left.
To warm it up, not to heat it up.
Right. And if you want, you can throw it right on the barbecue grill. Just give it a couple of quick turns over a super hot fire. So you end up charring the shell a little bit, but you're not making it hot.
Right.
Because I love that smell of charred crab. Mm, so good. Mm. Thank you both for joining us. It was a pleasure to have you here for our Seafood 101 month. And stay tuned and go to the grocery store and stay tuned for more information and go to the grocery and buy yourself some fish.
Put crab for Thanksgiving on the table.
That's a good idea.
Good.
A little crab feed for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Start a
absolutely.
New movement.
Sounds fantastic. Up next, we have Kitchen Conundrums. Madeline, you were on our Facebook page checking out some questions that people have. And we are going to answer those as soon as we come back on the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio. Chef in the Chapeau.
Monsieur Douglas.
How are you, sir?
I am fabulous. And now that I've had some beautiful birdie crab, I feel very contented. I feel like somebody who has already a lucky day.
Yes, indeed.
Crab for breakfast. Life is beautiful.
Our producer, Madeline Dow Pennington, has been on our Facebook page, Hot Stove Society, Hot Stove Show, right?
Yep, Hot Stove Radio Show on Facebook.
And you have found some interesting questions for us.
I have. You know, now's the time everybody's getting ready to sort of start cooking for the holidays, and I figured we have not done our Kitchen Conundrums segment, and we got a lot of questions, actually. Thierry, I know you saw a couple already, but we had a first question from our wonderful listener, Brian Cunningham, who reminded us it is chanterelle season, and he wants to know what to do with all these wonderful chanterelles, maybe on someone's new wood-fired pizza crust that you can get at Met Market, or blonde pizza, tomato base. What are some of your favorite ways to cook chanterelles for our listener, Brian?
I'm a brown butter kind of mushroom in general kind of guy, so, you know, I have a pan that's hot, drop in some butter. Let it get to the stage past the white for me. Get to the blonde, slightly dark stage. Drop in your mushroom. Don't overcrowd your pan. And just leave it alone. Don't touch it for at least 30 seconds until the mushroom actually has a chance to crisp up. Especially this time of year, you know, the mushroom have a tendency to be wet. So if they're wet, they will release their water. That's a natural process. But if they're not wet and they're fairly dry, they will definitely sear on the outside and have this beautiful nuttiness added to the flavor of the mushroom, which is already fairly nutty. So you had woodsiness and nuttiness to the chanterelle, and I think it's a beautiful mushroom.
Mm-hmm. I think this time of year it's tough to get a good flavored chanterelle.
Yeah, it's tough.
They tend to be wet and just kind of washed out. Those summer, dry kind of summer chanterelles,
right,
from a chanterelle perspective, are really the ones. So I do agree with you that you do have to give them a sear, but I also like to cook them down.
Right.
You know, evaporate that water. Just like, you know how just a regular mushroom,
yeah,
when you cook it down and evaporate the moisture, they become much more intense.
Correct.
And the chanterelle gets a little bit more intense. So, there's that way. I just made them, not on pizza, but you can at the Met Markets get our shells. I just made it, reduced it down with some Prosser Farm sweet onions.
Yum.
Reduced it down and put it into my cabbage rolls. I made my annual batch of cabbage rolls for the freezer.
That sounds
and,
good.
And maybe at this point, I should give away two of my cabbage rolls. They were pretty good.
The
only change this year is I used Genmai rice instead of wild rice because I was out of wild rice. So the rice is actually much more fragrant and stronger component than what I kind of wanted it to be, but it's still delicious.
Yum.
Anyway. Also, pickling those chanterelles is a good idea, especially when they're a little bit wet like this.
Mm.
Make a quick pickling juice and then put your chanterelle in there. They will last. And
They get a little slimy to me.
They get a little bit slimy, but they're great for Thanksgiving. Yeah. Think about Thanksgiving. It's a few
a little slimy
weeks away
on Thanksgiving.
All right, our listener, we have another listener question. Eric McIntyre wanted to know, what are other ways to use pumpkins other than pies?
Boom. Small ones, sugar pies. I peel, char. You don't even have to peel if you want. You can just cut it out after it's cooked. But peel, oven roast like you would cauliflower or any sort of roasted vegetable, and then make a little salad with escarole or some sort of bitter green like radicchio, because pumpkin gets sweet in the oven. And then a little goat cheese, a little toasted hazelnuts, a little mustard vinaigrette. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah, that sounds delicious. Even soups. They make great soup. Pumpkin makes a fabulous soup.
Oh, yeah.
Then you can, you know, you have that and you can put a few in the freezers for backup. But, you know, you put it out, you just warm it up. A little, like Tom said, a little goat cheese, a little crostini, some fresh herbs right on top, you know, end of the season right now for basil and chives, and all that stuff's going to start dying as soon as it freezes. So use all that stuff, tarragon, you know, end of the tarragon season. So drop a little tarragon in there, fresh olive oil, and you get this beautiful soup on your hand. Toasted pumpkin seed.
Yum.
You know, if you have pumpkin seed, put that in there as a crunch. It's delicious.
I was at the farm yesterday, and Jackie and Dev had just harvested all of our Treviso and radicchio bulbs, big, beautiful, like you find in the grocery store.
Right.
I didn't even know we could grow them like that, but the big totes of radicchio. And and the best part was, you know, there's a lot of trim, just like cabbage. You know, when you go into a cabbage field or a radicchio field, there's a lot of leaves on the outside that you don't use. And she had brought all those up for the neighbor's goats. They went crazy.
Oh, yeah.
For the radicchio. Who knew that goats love radicchio so much?
Bitter. They're very bitter. Bitter animals.
But it is definitely something this time of year. This is when we start using all the bitter radicchio, endive, arugula, all those different strong greens that you add to your. And you don't have to have just that on the plate. You can mix it with something else. You know, it's radicchio and endive, I think, is a great match.
If you want to see nature in action, go to watch a bunch of goats eat a huge pile of radicchio when they're used to kind of foraging along a desert floor with nothing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, as soon as the food comes in the front, all the food comes out the back.
We'll live stream. Live stream from there next time. Tune in. All right, listener Russell Nash wants to know, what is the most effective way to cook crispy bacon without all the mess and grease splatter? What are your favorite products and brands as well?
Go ahead.
If you have a bunch of sliced bacon, my favorite way to do it is to put it on the rack, you know, like a pastry rack, and put it on the sheet pan, put it in the oven flat like this, and then let it cook gently in the oven. I don't personally like super dark, crispy, crunchy bacon. That's not my favorite way to cook bacon. I like to have bacon cooked all the way till there is still a little give.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I like my bacon. So that's how I cook my bacon.
I think everyone's a little bit different that way, but if you take it too far, it does taste a little burnt to me.
Yeah, and it's not. It does not remind me of bacon. It reminds me of salt.
It kind of disintegrates in your mouth almost.
Yeah.
I would say also, to avoid the mess, I'm a big fan of parchment paper, just to put underneath the rack there, and then you can just throw it away.
Rid of the rack and just put it on parchment paper in a little baking sheet that has an edge because of the grease, it works fine too, but it does come out a little fattier because it cooks in its own fat like it does in a saute pan.
Right. Do you have favorite brands or products that you prefer?
If I'm feeling rich, I buy the Newskies because it's got a real strong smoke, and I love getting the bacon fat afterwards because now it really works in every area that I want.
I like the Newski uncured.
Uncured?
Yeah, I like the...
Bacon's one of those things I buy across all brands so that I'm always looking for the favorite one. But, of course, my favorite for years, for the last 40 years, has been the Bavarian Meats bacon, but they're not in the market anymore, so can't have it.
All right. Lori Dragstess wants to know about quince. She just got a big bag from a friend. She usually cooks them down with apples for applesauce, but do you have any ideas on how to use them that highlights their unique flavor?
Peel them, which is already a big task because the skin is harder than a rock, and cut them into quarters and do a little quick butter, sugar, quince into a pan and caramelize them individually in pieces like you would apples for tartatin or whatever, and finish with a dash of vinegar, red wine vinegar or white wine vinegar at the end. And then you have a sweet and sour kind of quince fruit on your plate. So you can use that as a garnish for roasted meat, for different dishes.
I use a cheese board.
I use it with foie gras. It's delicious.
Yum.
The ones we got off our tree in our backyard this year were spectacular.
Yeah.
We just made them into a tartatin style quince. You do the same thing with the quince, right? And then you take the juices and you reduce those to a caramel, put your pastry on top, put it in a pan in the oven, cook it up, turn it out, and you've got a beautiful kind of upside-down tart. Yeah.
But I think the quince apple puree kind of idea, cook slowly down. The two of them, I usually cook them separately and then add them at the end because the quince takes a little bit longer to cook than the apple. And a nice dash of Calvados at the end and put that in a little canning jar. Can a whole bunch of them and give them away for Christmas. Boom, dang.
That's a good one. I like that. All right, our last question we have from listener Ellen Riggs. These big puffball mushrooms seem to be trending. I have a picture that I will post on our Facebook page so people know what we're talking about. We want to know, where can you find them? How do you cook them? Do you store them after you cut it? Have you seen these around? Disclaimer.
We take no responsibility for your personal health.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. They're safe to consume.
To me, they're probably just as dangerous as the next segment later on in the show with the breakfast sandwiches from around town.
No, I think puffball, when I was a kid, we used to pick them in the field. I have never seen them, anybody come to my back door and go, oh, maybe once or twice, some pickers. But other than that, in the stores, I've never seen them in a store for sale. They can get giant, like a big ball. And the way we used to do it is just make steaks, you know, about half an inch, three-quarter inch thick, and then pan fry in brown butter. Again, with butter, everything is better. And salt and pepper, and that's it. And use that, put that on a plate as a base for, like you would a portobello or anything like this. And then from there, you can do salted vegetable. You can do, if you have salmon, or if you have, we were talking about crab earlier.
Oh, yeah.
It would be delicious on top of that with a little bit of that brown butter, finished with a little bit of sherry vinegar, and put that right on top. So you'd have a hot sherry vinaigrette kind of idea.
I'm surprised they're dense enough to do that.
Very dense. Ah. Yeah, they're dense.
Those like a head of cauliflower almost. You can do pretty much.
Not quite as dry, but yes, they're very puffball. Actually, they are dry of a mushroom in a way, and they're very dense. You can do steaks, and where I come from, we definitely in France we use them, and we eat them for sure.
Where I come from, we eat cornbread and chicken.
Where I come from, we eat puffball
sticks.
I will
look it up. Don't know.
Look it up. You could actually grill them on the barbecue, too, if you had it.
If you have a kitchen conundrum, please send it to us. You can email it to us at hotstoveradioshow@tomdouglas.com, or you can also post it on our Facebook page at Hot Stove Radio, and we'll try to capture it and have you solve it.
I'm going to guess, and you could, you might get two cabbage rolls if I'm wrong. Alan Jackson, that's my guess.
Okay.
Don't know. Where I come from. Up next, we're going to talk beets. I know this isn't my favorite subject of the world, and you love beets.
Something
and
you
I
don't
just,
like.
I just had to transport the last of the beets from our farm to our warehouse kitchen. And so let's talk beets for a few minutes on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. It's the Hot Stove Society Show. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. It's time to talk beets.
Favorite.
I know. I'm just not the biggest fan. You know what's odd? And I think they have somewhat the same flavors. I love beet greens.
Yeah.
But there's something about green vegetables I just like. So, beets.
I know you're a big fan of greens, but beets, definitely to me, the attraction to beet is kind of that earthiness with slightly sweet, you know, sweet flavor in the background.
Yeah.
Then you can transform, or you can add on, or you can just as is have on a plate, and it's very delicious.
Right.
I think it's a delicious vegetable.
So I just got back from the farm with almost the last totes of stuff. Maybe we have 30 totes of potatoes left and a few peppers. It was supposed to freeze tonight, so they tried to pick everything out.
I'm not surprised.
That wasn't in the hoop house. Tried to get everything riled up. But anyway, got the beets. Washed the greens separately from the beets themselves. All the beets are ready to be roasted and then peeled, which is a way that I would really suggest. You just take the beets. I wash them a little bit of olive oil, and then I roast them until they're cooked all the way through.
Correct.
Let them cool, and then if you just put on a pair of gloves, you can easily just scrape the skins right off of the beets. You don't have to try and peel them.
Now, one good way to remind the listener to do, when you roast beets, it's nice to leave a little bit of the stem and don't cut off the root. Just leave them whole because it will allow the beet not to bleed while you're roasting it.
Okay.
If you cut the stem and you cut the roots, unfortunately, your beet will bleed. You will lose some of the flavor and also it will be bleeding.
Flavor and color and...
Yeah.
Yeah.
So just keep them, just keep a little bit of the stem, keep the roots in there, roast them just like that, 400 degrees, no, it's 375 for a couple of hours, probably, depends on the size of it. And then just use a knife and don't poke through the beet, just press on the beet to see if it's tender, if it has some give. Once it has some give, just take them out of the oven, let them sit outside until they cool off, and then, like you said, gloves on, peel them off.
Yeah.
Easy.
Now, if you don't want to cook beet, we'll get back to cooked beets in a minute, but the other night we took the same beets and we did peel them.
Right.
And we put them on the mandolin, super thin, right, and gave them a quick shave, and then we lightly pickled them in a horseradish vinegar.
Yeah.
So just fresh horseradish and white wine vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
They really came out delicious. I love that combination. They stay super crunchy. And I mixed them with, or Dev mixed them with some pickled daikon. It was a really beautiful, nice combination. And so don't feel like you always have to cook your beets.
Correct. If you want to test a beautiful raw beet salad, super thinly sliced, you go to the Harvest Vine. They've had it for years now, that dish. And I think I've had it every time I've been there. It's a beautiful plate. It's very, very thinly sliced beet.
I've had it there, too, but it was a cooked beet that I had there.
Oh, okay. I've had raw beets there.
Okay.
And they do a good job at just...
Like a beet carpaccio, right?
Kind of idea, yes.
I've had that dish.
Yeah, and just beautiful olive oil. This is when you use that very expensive olive oil, that beautiful finished sea salt, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Keep it simple. You know, a dash of sherry vinegar if you want, and then it makes for a beautiful, beautiful appetizer.
Mm-hmm.
But beet soup is also something that a lot of people are not as familiar with in terms of thinking about it or even trying it. But, you know, it's very common in Eastern Europe to have a beet soup, like a borscht kind of idea.
We're going to have a Latvian chef on later, so.
I know. I'm kind of propping that.
Mm-hmm.
But beets is, you know, you can do a beautiful soup with that finish with a nice creme fraiche or sour cream or, you know, something with a little tanginess to it. And it makes a wonderful starter to a meal. And you can have it cold, you can have it hot, you can have it any way you want.
How do you, because you use beets personally much more than I do, right?
Yes.
So you've got a cooked beet, it's all peeled and ready to go, you've diced it up for a salad. How do you get it to not bleed into the rest of the food at that point? Or do you just, when you do your salad, are you just finishing with the chopped beet so that it doesn't bleed onto your green lettuces?
Okay, so there is two type of beet. There's the beets that you just made that are still room temp, have not been refrigerated.
But they're out of the oven.
They're peeled. They're just room temp. They're peeled. They're diced.
Okay.
They're the most beautiful beets because they haven't been refrigerated yet.
Right.
So they haven't been touched. They're just freshly roasted. You just finish it with a little bit of olive oil, salt, pepper, and fresh herbs if you have like chives. And that's it. At the last minute.
I understand that. I said if you're going to add them to other ingredients in a salad...
I put them at the last minute.
The last second. Okay.
So I can actually really taste that beautiful beet. And I always toss them in a little bit of oil. Even if I'm going to mix it into a salad, I take a little bit of olive oil, salt and pepper, and season the beet at its own, and then add it to a salad. So I don't have to retouch that because it can taste a little bit bland of its own if you just take it and just like potato, if you just mix it into a salad and it's not well incorporated for a long time, the flavor stays pretty raw.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to have, you know, the beets macerating a little bit and have a coating on that beet. That's the way I like to do it.
Right.
But if they have been refrigerated, it's a different story because they've already have been refrigerated, so everything has calmed down and sealed into that beet. So now I'm dicing those beets that have been refrigerated, and I'm definitely going to pre-marinate it. I will most likely add a little bit of acid in there, a dash of vinegar, red wine vinegar usually, olive oil, salt, pepper, and I will let it macerate on the counter and keep tossing it around so all the pieces have equal chance of, you know, flavor. Then I will add it to whatever I'm doing or serve it as is.
I really like when I'm serving beets to kind of serve a medley of colors.
Yeah.
And so my favorite are the golden beets. For some reason, they don't seem to have quite as earthy tone
as the red
beets do. So if I'm going to eat beets, those are the ones that I want, are the golden ones.
See, I'm a big fan of the...
And I honestly, I won't buy a beet unless it has beautiful beet greens or a right on top.
My favorite beet is... one that has gone through the winter.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. They're so delicious, earthy, sweet. I mean, you have nothing to do to that. It's a gorgeous vegetable on its own. So February, March, those are the good months to eat the best overwinter beets.
Oh, yeah. My mother is responsible for my dread of beets because she always had those jars of pickled beets in the fridge. And for some reason, you know, it's like she would pull them out on holidays, you know, when you're supposed to, everything's supposed to be special. And then she would put these horrible pickled beets on things, and it would it made me crazy. If I'm going to eat a beet, she also is responsible for getting me to eat them when she made her Harvard beets. That's what she called them, Harvard beets, which
Harvard.
Are sweet and sour beets. So you take the beets and you cook them in a little sweet and sour, like vinegar and sugar boil, and then you thicken it with the cornstarch, right? So you have just like Chinatown sweet and sour pork, that same kind of sweet and sour beets. And then I took the beet greens, sauteed them down, put them on the bottom of the plate, and then put the little bit of sweet and sour beets on top.
Right.
Now I can actually sit down to a plate of beets.
No, that sounds delicious, yes. Yeah. And it's a great garnish. Beets is a great touch. It's a great garnish to a roast pork or any kind of roast then you're going to do. It's really, really sustainable that way. You know, Thanksgiving, you should definitely have roasted beets around the turkey, I think.
All right. Up next in the Hot Stove Society kitchen, it's time to preview a few tastes from Chinatown, because I've been getting down there a bit lately, and sadly, a lot of it's still boarded up, but it's starting to come back alive. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to hour number two of the Hot Stove Society radio show. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in the hat.
We've got another big hour for you. In this next hour, we're going to be tortured by Amy Richardson, one of our producers. She has been to every fast food joint in the city this morning getting breakfast sandwiches, and we're going to either love them, which is what I'm going to do, or hate them, which is Chef Terry's going to do. Carlos Kelms is here to chat about cooking travels and some favorite delicious Latvian dishes that he makes. And finally, our favorite subject, food for thought, tasty trivia. We're going to go whole hog into that.
Are you going to win today?
Let's. I never win anymore because Madeline hates me. Yes, I'm whining. But first, let's talk a little bit about the ID. And that's the International District, and so much going on down there. I have not missed a beat when it comes to Thai Tung Restaurant, which is kind of my go-to when I'm having lunch or dinner. I have the same dish every time. Isn't it funny how some restaurants just do that to you, right?
I believe that strongly because I go across the street to J Asian Bistro across from Luke in Madison Valley, and I always have the dragon roll because I love his dragon roll.
Uh-huh.
And, God, I'm hungry. I have nothing. I don't feel like cooking or whatever. I'm in a hurry. I'll just call Jay and say, hey, can I get a dragon roll?
Yeah.
And
I think that's when it happens the most, when you go to something that you know what you're going to get before you even walk in the front door.
Right.
I think it's when you're super hungry.
Right.
It's like you don't want to mess around. You just want to eat, and you want it to be good, and you don't want any surprises.
Baba's going to be the oxtail pho.
Yeah. And I go to Thai Tung, and I have the Chinese greens with fish. That's my little dish there. So, and with a little chili sauce on the side, done.
That sounds delicious.
I still have been going there. Where else do you like to go in the International District?
Well, right across the...
makes you happy.
You know, right across from Thai Tung, Khao Khao, which is probably my favorite place to get anything barbecue. When I think barbecue, mm-hmm. it's funny because that's the first place I think about before I even think of Jack's Barbecue or any of these places. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking, oh, I gotta go to Cacao and get some nice pork. Chewing on that pork is just so delicious. There's always more than I need. There's always, you know, a couple of meals in there. And just come home and have a little rice and put that on top of it, little sauce if needs to be, and, you know, some sauteed vegetable if there are. But at Grand List, just that barbecue pork. And by the way, there's no way in the world I can have that sitting next to me in my car and not start chewing before I get home.
Eat it on the way home, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I go to King's Barbecue House personally. That's down there across from the old Wajamaya. Right there. I don't know what the name of the street is, but it's between King Street and, again, I don't remember the name. I don't know. I just go to by feel in the International District, but they are only barbecue. And sometimes when I'm feeling kind of trashy at lunchtime, because normally I like a balanced meal. I really want vegetables with my lunch, but they only do rice and barbecue. So the other thing about Chinatown Barbecue Houses is that when you go, like when I go, I buy a duck. Yeah. I buy a pound of roast pork, which is kind of the big slabs of pork. And I buy a pound of char siu, the kind of barbecue pork. And I take them, like, on my way to the farm. I'll take them all to the farm, and I pick them or chop them in a way that I put them in little containers, have them in the freezer. So the next time I want to make fried rice at the farm, I can pull out real Chinatown.
Some tacos or whatever.
Yeah, right. No tacos. But, no? But that, no, it's just not. It's Chinatown.
I don't see. I can't believe a guy like you who crosses all culture is saying no.
I cook all cultures. I try not to crisscross them.
Okay,
that's fair. That's fair. Yeah, in the middle. So anyway, point being is I like having little tubs of this kind of Chinatown barbecue flavor in my freezer to make when I'm trying to make a good fried rice or trying to make a beautiful duck soup.
Yeah,
I just pull out the picked duck, and I've already made the broth from the bones. So.
That sounds delicious. Plus, you get all those vegetables right around you at the farm. Uh-huh.
So now you go to Ba Bar. I went there the other day and had pho. I tend to go to pho at the Pho Bok Sup Shop now.
Sure.
Which is, the original Pho Bok, which is kind of the Chinese junk or Vietnamese junk. I'm not sure what the name of that ship is called now. But you know those junks? I think that's what they're called,
NKs,
I think they're called junks. And the building was in the shape of the
boat.
The boat right there on the corner. Well, now just to the west of that, they have opened the Sup Shop, S-U-P. Right. And the junk has got a traveling roadshow in it right now. It's fried chicken in the original Pho Bok.
Is it?
Yeah. And then the Sup Shop, I really like their short rib beef pho now. You actually, the bones stick out of the bowl and everything, and it's good. Sometimes they don't heat the short rib enough. Like, it comes out a little cold.
Yeah.
But so I like it when it's super hot and delicious. But anyway, that's my kind of go-to for pho.
Well, right, it's now. Definitely a good place. Pho Bok was always a classic, definitely a traditional. You see all those workers who are with their helmet and their, not their helmet, their hat, their working hats. And
Where do you go for sushi now? I've kind of moved out of the ID personally for sushi. I used to go to Maneki all the time. They're closed right now, but Shiro down at Kashiba is one of my favorites, although it tends to be hard to get in, and it's very expensive.
Right.
You got to go in prepared.
You can't just go straight into that for to go.
If I lived in your neighborhood,
I would go to Nishino.
Nishino.
Yeah. Nishino is a great spot for, you can't miss that. It's got great sushi, great hot and cold, actually, both. All the dishes that are on that menu are very interesting Japanese dishes, whether it's hot or cold. My kids' favorite line is, what do you want to do for your birthday? Oh, Nishino.
Be Palace Kitchen. I'm so sad. It used to be Palace Kitchen.
Yeah, they were raised in a poor house, I guess. You know, it's like I go, oh, Nishino is... Last time my son turned 26, he was like, Nishino. Oh, Nishino was closed. Yes.
Saved about $500
there. Some money.
What about Vietnamese food? I know you said just a couple of weeks ago you went to the Tamarind Tree.
Yeah.
I've been to Greenleaf a couple of times.
I love Greenleaf and I love Tamarind Tree, both of those places. And I must say, the Tamarind Tree, I hadn't been in quite some time. I was very impressed. Extremely good. I recommend it strongly. I hadn't been there in probably 3 years, I'm sorry to say. But it was absolutely delicious. Great cocktails. and great lunch.
And Madeline, you put down here that Shukushinbo is your favorite Japanese restaurant.
My all-time favorite. I love that place. It's incredible sushi. That's where I was introduced to the most succulent salmon collars that I've had there. They just do a wonderful job. Super lightly seared on the outside. I could eat that every day. But I love that tiny little space. I know that they are doing some great takeout, I believe, and are trying to stay in business while we can all go down there and do some fun stuff down there. It's delicious.
All right, up next, Amy's, I can see her back there putting together all these breakfast sandwiches from the drive-thrus around the city. And we're going to try a selection next on the Hot Stove Society radio show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio. Oh, my God, Jerry, are you going to make it through this segment?
My God. These are why I don't eat that stuff.
We are right smack in the middle of a combination of Torture Tom and Terry and a Hot Stove Society tasting panel segment. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the tortured guy today.
The chef in the English muffin today. So, Amy, do you want to explain to us what you're doing to us and why?
Yes. Well, we are doing the ultimate drive-through breakfast sandwiches, the perfect cure for a hangover or a long road trip. We should have told you to drink more last night to be hungover to enjoy these.
And the criteria for this particular tasting panel is... where did you start on Aurora and every place you could on the way to downtown?
Yeah, I started on 175th. And then I flipped, I turned right on 85th and went to Ballard to hit up Wendy's because the other Wendy's was all the way up in Everett.
Okay. Well, Wendy's is, if I'm going to have a breakfast sandwich, that's generally where I go because... Yeah. Ours is closed right now,
yeah.
And Wendy's is on my way to work.
Yeah, so, this was the inspiration. Yeah. We know that you do enjoy a Wendy's biscuit.
Yeah. So anyway, the chef of the chapeau is turning a little bit green right now.
Definitely.
We have a couple of firsts this morning, chef. Oh, tell me one of the firsts that you've had this morning.
Okay, so this one, I don't know what the brand is.
That is number one. That is Burger King.
Burger King. So I have never had one of that. Actually, I've never had any of these in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So
you're
it's
welcome.
A nice discovery for me. I must say, the only breakfast sandwich I've had, congratulations to you, is the bakery across the street.
Dahlia Bakery.
Dahlia Bakery. And I must say, if they were all like that, that would be perfect.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, from what I'm trying so far, the flavor in general is dry. Mm-hmm. The next flavor is salt or sugar, which means sweet or salty. And the next flavor is that patty of, I guess it's a sausage.
The sausage, yes. You tried the Burger King with the biscuit and the croissant with American cheese and sausage.
And one had bacon on it, too.
And one had bacon. They were both $2.99 and come in at 520 calories.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's a good thing I only took a bite because...
Yeah, but we took a bite of 10 of them. That's the problem. All right. So if I'm going to answer on that, I'm going to take those off the list. Those aren't, aren't doing it
all
for
right.
me.
Okay. So number two was Wendy's.
Uh-huh.
And this is a sausage, egg, and cheese biscuit at 610 calories, coming in at $3.39.
Well, I will tell you that normally when I get the Wendy's one, which I do maybe once a month or so, or once a week, I'm not sure. The sausage is always browned better than what's on here. So that's a little bit disappointing. But I would do the sausage over the regular bun version. I mean, the biscuit over the bun version any day.
Got it.
And how much was that? That was, if I'm not mistaken, with tax, $3.49.
Oh, yes. $3.39.
39 cents.
Very friendly service.
How much is a breakfast sandwich at the Dahlia Bakery?
$18.
Yeah. See, to me, that's worth five times this.
No. It's $8.
Yeah, well, definitely worth twice as much.
Yeah, we make our own English muffins. Well, I mean, we make everything.
I mean, unfortunately, when you said the biscuit was better for you. To me, it's drier than a shoe.
Yeah. Well, I don't eat many shoes, so I don't know. let's talk about the Chick-fil-A biscuit.
Okay,
how long did you have
six.
To wait first?
Oh, right. That was a long line. I literally had a whole conversation with my mother on the phone during that line.
Oh, okay. And it's also the smallest sandwich.
It is the smallest. That was $3.39. It's a hand-breaded, seasoned chicken breast. It's fried in peanut oil with a buttermilk biscuit. 460 calories.
Oh, it's less than I thought.
Well, it's half the size, so, yeah.
Well, yeah, but the calories.
Okay, the one I thought I was going to like best, I don't like best.
Ah, which one?
The Starbucks. Mm. Tell us about that one.
Okay, that has fluffy eggs, cheddar, a toasty English muffin, and a savory sausage. That is $3.95 at 480 calories.
And the sausage is literally looks like it's poached. There's not one bit of brown on it, and that's what's sad about this. I do like the extra toasted English muffin. Yeah. That's a nice touch.
And the only one that uses cheddar.
Out of instead of American cheese type,
yes,
type
yes.
stuff?
Yes, yeah. When we get to Jack in the Box, they do have a Swiss cheese sauce.
I have a visceral reaction to the Jack in the Box brand. It's just not something I ever go to.
Yeah. It wasn't my favorite experience this morning.
Oh, really? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to that in just a minute. But as far as the sandwich goes,
Yeah, so that was a loaded breakfast sandwich. Okay, so why you have so many sandwiches, too, I did ask for their biggest sellers because I had a hard time picking these out.
Okay.
All on my own. Loaded breakfast sandwich with a freshly cracked egg, hickory smoked bacon, ham, sausage, American cheese, toasted sourdough, and a Swiss cheese sauce.
This one actually has brown sausage, and there's two eggs on there.
Two eggs?
Why we need two eggs, I don't know. But how much was this?
This was $4.39, and I think this won today at 770 calories.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. Okay, let's move on to the last one, which is three different McDonald's sandwiches.
Yes, now that's where I had a hard time deciding, so that's why I bought so many. But you have the Egg McMuffin.
That I know what you could decide.
So it's a sausage McMuffin.
Yes, and I will say this had the longest line.
More
the
than
longest
Chick-fil-A?
Of Chick-fil-A. It was huge.
Wow.
And this is $4.19 at 310 calories.
You pay more and get less calories.
Yeah.
I like it.
And then what Terry was surprised and delighted with was the McGriddle. That is a warm griddled cake with sweet maple syrup.
It's like a pancake on the as far as that makes a pancake for your bun.
It's a little pancake.
I have a trashy craving for these once in a while.
I do know this about you.
Yeah.
At summer camp.
Sometimes when I'm heading to the farm and I've got a long, 3-hour drive, I'll buy two.
Ooh.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah.
And one is enough for Jackie?
I'm not too proud. I'm just saying.
Okay. Two of these?
Okay.
I thought you'd get your lesson.
And there's
on
also
the
a biscuit there, too.
Yes,
right?
And so you had the biscuit. The biscuit, sausage, egg, and cheese, and that's $2.19 at 430 calories.
Okay, Chef, now's the time. This is the first time you've eaten at McDonald's, is that right?
Oh, yeah, first time.
That's Jack in the Box.
That's the toasted sourdough bun. There's extra effort there.
Extra effort. Most expensive.
No, you know what I like about this is the bread is actually nicely toasted, so I think it... This is a little motion for me as far as I'm concerned.
So you're going for Jack in the Box out of this group.
The rest of the sandwich is okay, but yes, I would definitely, I like the fact that there is more eggs, so I don't have to taste everything else. it's actually good that way. yes, I would say I'm disappointed by the Starbucks needs some help.
Yeah, I don't quite get it. I would have, like I said, I would have guessed with looking at this group when it came in that the Starbucks would have been my favorite, but it's not. Yeah.
And it's just because it's not complete on all the different functions that are of what's in there. I think better searing on the sausage, better the bun is a bit too mushy. It's not mushy; it's soft, and it should be crispier. So I think that would help if they did all that, and the eggs a little bit slightly under.
I think that the Chick-fil-A. Mm-hmm. If I was to wait in line and order this for my breakfast, I'd be sadly disappointed.
Oh, I would be so mad.
Yeah, because it's so small. I mean, there's literally a 2-ounce piece of a chicken on it. It's just sadly gross.
The biscuit. I just had biscuit in Texas and in Arkansas. This is not a better biscuit. I'm sorry. You can do better than that.
If I had to pick one out of this group, I'm going for the McGriddle.
McGriddle.
It doesn't try to be anything but trashy good, and that's what it is.
So McGriddle over your Wendy's.
Yes.
Wow.
And you know why, I would say? Because when the Wendy's breakfast first came out, like maybe 7 or 8 months ago, it was a much better biscuit sandwich.
Mm.
Now they are not putting butter on the top. I mean, it's just
which one of the McGriddle?
Oh, that first one with the pancakes on the outside there.
Oh, the sweet one.
Yes.
Interesting.
What is that? What is that vicious laugh that you just had there?
Well, because I'm like, I would
Amy, do you have a favorite?
That.
Well, I have to say, I did not try any of them.
That is unreasonable.
Well,
if we have to try them, you have to try them.
Now is the time.
Madeline and I will try them for sure.
We have Carlos Kelms here. He is going to be talking a little bit about Latvian food.
I can't wait.
Yeah, so good. On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotureau, the chef in the hat.
Well, we're going to jump in after that debacle of Torture Tom and Terry and the Hot Stove Society tasting panel on breakfast sandwiches on Aurora, specific from 175th to downtown Ballard. We're going to jump right in to talk to chef instructor Carlos Kelms. He is currently residing in his 1986 VW van by a river somewhere. Who knows? We're not going to get too specific. Born and raised in Seattle and studied at the California Culinary Academy in San Francisco. Welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
How's your life?
Life is good, different, but I really can't complain. I'm pretty happy.
You could if you'd like. We're here to listen.
Oh, no. I didn't think this was therapy. Thanks, though.
So you brought in some notes on Latvian cooking. Why don't you tell us how you got down that path and your family history and things?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up here in the Seattle area, and there's quite a strong Latvian community here in the Seattle area. We've got a Latvian community church up in North Seattle, Northgate there. And I was very involved in that community growing up, and we went to Latvian language schools on Saturday on the 6th
really?
Day. Yeah.
Crazy.
And then up to Latvian summer camps down in Shelton. Spent the summers out there learning the folk dancing, the culture, the tradition, and also eating the food. So when I came in, I heard you talking about pickled beets and like smoked, you know, chicken and all these like funky flavors, salted fish and, you know, like meat jellies. And I'm just like, oh yeah, I hated that stuff once upon a time too. But somehow, you know, your taste changed. So, and I got into food cooking in high school, started cooking there in high school and taking classes over at Bellevue High School, and then went on to the California Culinary Academy, and kind of food became my world. And I wound up going back to Europe, got wanderlust and settled in Riga, and one thing led to another. I thought I'd be there for a couple of months, and it turned into about 15 years.
15 years in Riga, which is the capital of Latvia.
Riga is the capital city, correct.
So it's to locate city. Latvia, let's put it between Estonia and Lithuania. And
That might not help a lot of people.
right on the Baltic Sea.
That's right.
A swim across Denmark and
Sweden.
I was going to say Finland.
Just
to make sure people have an idea of where that is.
East of Sweden, bordering, Belarus and Russia as well.
Yeah. So I want to give a big shout out to the Grigas family because they're friends of mine and Caroline especially, and very big Latvia family. So I actually know some Latvian people.
So what turned you around? What you're sitting there as a kid, you're kind of forced into all this stuff as many families do to their children, and then you want to rebel and you move away from it. What turned you back in the direction of Latvian food?
The funny thing was I never really rebelled against Latvian. I liked the sense of community, and I kind of understood from an early age that the people in that community were going to be part of my life forever, just because I saw how strong that community was and what they'd gone through immigrating. It was an exile community from the Second World War. But the food thing was really, it took me being over there. There was a few dishes that I always liked. They have these little dumplings called piragi, which is basically like a nice sweet dough with a little bit of ham and onion minced up inside. Real simple peasant food. And, you know, some other dishes that, you know, were tolerable. I was like half and half on sauerkraut and whatnot. But when I got over there, I guess like there was a while where I was like, just turned off by it, and I was like, wait a second, you're a chef, like you've got to be looking for good things and unique flavors everywhere. And it took me a while to just accommodate. I think that when I left the States, that was 2005, pickles weren't as hot as they are now. It took
that's
another
for
10
sure.
years,
yeah.
right?
Except if you're in Korea or someplace like that.
Totally. Like Japan. Kimchi was maybe something that people were talking about. And so I just started dabbling and looking for good things in all of it. And then, as in so many things with food, it might sound selfish, but I started to cook it and prepare it for myself and gain confidence in the techniques and such that went into it and started to understand it and what you were looking for by using those techniques. And that's when the light bulb went on for me. That's when I really started to love it and also get the stories behind it, because you know, there's so many wonderful people that have been making these things for centuries, and it's just what they know and what they do.
Right.
And in Latvia, they didn't have a lot of pride in their food. Like a lot of small countries, they don't take a lot of pride in their national cuisine until people start to respect it and say, actually, it's pretty delicious. Mm-hmm. So I tried to take that attitude and turn it to them. They're like, oh, you like it? And then you see a sense of pride coming to people. So,
and it represents their history, too. I mean, there's a reason why those dishes came about.
100%.
Sometimes it's, you know, the farmer needed something during the day on the tractor, or, you know, there's, you just never know where these dishes come from.
Yeah, right. It's sustenance. I mean, the national dish of Latvia is gray peas and bacon. So it's like dried peas.
Yeah, that's right, you know, that's right.
Because they were probably poor,
rendered,
right?
A little bit of onion and a huge dollop sour cream. They're very poor.
That looks really delicious.
It is delicious. You're like, that's what I want. If I was out, like, tilling the, you know, cabbage fields, like, by myself, you know, pulling the hoe, like, I would probably want that for lunch, not to mention, like, a half a pound of pork fat that's right. been salt-cured and, you know, has a pickle on it.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, and pork is number one in Latvia.
Pork is the number one consumed meat in Latvia, yeah. followed by chicken, then beef, and then lamb.
So. Yeah.
And then, of course, lots of fish, because you're right on, I mean, most of the country, not most,
lots
but
of
half
fish.
Of the country is on the coastal.
That's right. That's right. There's more than, like, 500 miles of coastline in Latvia, and you've got the Baltic Sea is not necessarily, like, super bountiful, but along the sea they have the Spratz, which is probably the most famous export of Latvia. Is
like the little Spratz. Sardines, like
that's right, like a sardine of sorts, like lightly smoked, packed and cured in oil. Those are beautiful. Freshwater fish, though, things like freshwater eel, lamprey, pike perch, walleye, bass. You get a lot of sturgeon there as well. Right. So those fish are beautiful, and they've got really nice methods. You know, I wasn't growing up in Seattle, smoked salmon was, you know, kind of the only smoked fish I was really familiar with. But then you get the mackerel and the herring and all the different, you know, flounder fish that they'll mm-hmm. smoke in different methods, both hot and cold smoked.
And sweet and sour, too.
Sweet and sour, pickling. Yeah. So the Riga Central Market is one of the largest, if not the largest, covered market area in all of Europe. It's five Zeppelin hangars that are essentially football fields mm-hmm. worth of farmer's market, not to mention the outdoor section. So walking through there, you know, that was some of my first experiences just being overwhelmed by that food, and it's everywhere. So and you get to talk to those people that are making it. Pretty fascinating place.
So right. you run culinary enrichment programs on Oceania Cruises and Regent Seven Seas Cruise Lines?
That's correct. I'm part of the faculty that oversees the cooking classes that we have on board, and we also oversee and develop culinary tours. I'm not in charge of that program. My boss, Catherine Kelly, she's another Seattle native. She set that program up. So she found me when they came to Riga. Uh-huh. And I led food tours for them in the Central Market. And then we got to know each other over about five summers of doing that. And she invited me to come on board, and there we go. Life changed.
Cool.
So
I looked up, because I don't know much about Latvian food, certainly not what you do, Chef, but I looked up some different dishes from Latvia that are popular there and kind of piqued my interest. So the number one thing was the Fritakula Zupa.
Frikadella zupa.
Frikadella zupa.
Yeah.
And is that just dough blobs in the soup, or is that a dumpling?
So it's funny. You were talking about the sausage being mm-hmm. like steamed, okay? Uh-huh. Frikadella zupa is actually little meatballs in the soup, but you just cook them and you steam them in there.
Oh, okay.
And you just boil them in the broth.
Because they look white.
So yeah, they look white, but you could use chicken. You could use turkey.
Oh, okay.
So it could be a different type of meat there. And oftentimes, if meat is short, which in a lot of times in Latvian histories it was, you'd maybe mix some breadcrumbs in there just like you would with a meatloaf as a right. filling or a binding agent, right?
Right.
So frikadella supa, some vegetables, light bouillon, a little bit of maybe dill or parsley, and that's a wrap. And always a slice of rye bread alongside.
Oh, yeah, and we got some good bread, some good rye bread.
I love good rye bread.
Yeah, the bread is, it's like, I kind of explain it, like there's that movie, like The Hobbit that came out, and they've got that magic bread that they carry with them, and they can just last for months, and it just powers them up. I mean, that's that bread.
Right.
It's, yeah.
No, I mean, the rye bread is definitely one of the highlights. So,
yeah.
To go with all those beautiful, like that bean stew. Oh,
yeah, it's
beautiful. You dunk that bread in there.
Yeah,
oh,
you can
man.
Mop up all the bacon fat and sour cream
yeah.
on there.
Yeah.
Another one is gricci.
Gricci, yeah.
Gricci?
Yeah. Gricci, yeah. That's
buckwheat.
Buckwheat, yeah. So buckwheat is, you know, widely used. Also, just it was the food of, you know, back in the day, historically speaking, you know, wheat flour, regular wheat flour, was reserved for the upper classes. And
right.
so the buckwheat was the peasant's, you know,
isn't
grain
that crazy
of choice.
How that works.
I know. And these days we're paying top dollar for the buckwheat.
I know.
I mean,
exactly.
I always call Latvia, like, the cuisine is like back to the future, because literally everything that Latvia has been eating, like, for their entire existence is now like the coolest thing in the world. Like everybody's all about it. And I got to Latvia and I was like, you guys are like way ahead of the curve. Just keep doing what you're doing. Like you're setting the trend. You forage, you smoke, you pickle, you do all these great things. And that's what the rest of the world is like thinking is a new thing and a cool thing to do.
Right.
All right. I only have 1 minute left and you have to tell me about your version of carbonade or Wiener Schnitzel.
Carbonade, yeah. So a carbonade would be, a Wiener Schnitzel. So there's the cutlet and the carbonade. The carbonade has got to be just breaded, right? Uh-huh. So I like to do it with veal. They got great veal there. Just pound it short. I like to put a little bit of rye crisp in there, okay? And then just...
In the breading?
Yeah, in the standard breading. So okay. I like to put a little bit of the rye flour into the breading. I prefer not to use the egg yolks in the breading. I like just the egg whites. I'm not going to say that's traditional Latvian.
You whip them at all?
Yeah, whip them up. Okay. I like the whites because it keeps it lighter. And then just go ahead, dredge them first in the flour and then into your...
Whites,
mm-hmm. and then finish it with a bit of the breadcrumbs. They use a lot of flour, but I'll just use the rye flour and regular flour. So, and that's it. And then when frying it, I always try to fry it in like an animal fat. So in like pork fat or bacon fat, something along those lines, even chicken fat.
That sounds so good. We're going to invite you to stay for a Food for Thought Tasty Trivia.
It's kind of you. Thank you. Are we going to be having breakfast sandwiches?
Yeah, you are. I've already had
you can.
I might go.
We've been talking with Carlos Selms about Latvian food. If you want to take one of his culinary instructs, you can go on Oceana Cruise Lines or Seven Seas Cruises, or I'm sure you can probably figure out how to get something local.
We want to have him on Hot Stove.
Yes,
he's
exactly.
Cook some Latvian food.
Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Hot Stove Society show. It's time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. This trivia is brought to you by Rub with Love. Handcrafted, versatile rubs, sauces, and mustards made by me. Yes, that's Tom Douglas's Rub with Love. And they add a flavorful kick and a whole lot of love to just about any meat, fish, or vegetable. Look for Rub with Love products in your local grocery store or butcher shops. Bartell's Drugs has our new Harvest Pack. Or find them online at TomDouglas.com or go to my buddy Stan. He's got a good selection of our rubs, too. He sells them on Amazon. So all sorts of places you can find Rub with Love. Madeline? Who's going to win our pack today?
Well, thank you. We have our fan and listener, Karen Fagerstrom, who is going to receive a brand new Harvest 3 pack. It's a must-have for any home kitchen this holiday season, complete with a jar of turkey rub, roast rub, and veggie rub. These Harvest 3 packs are quite adorable, Tom. I think they're going to be hot sellers. I'm excited. We are going to play our Food for Thought trivia, and Carlos has stuck around. Thank you. We're going to ask Tom, Thierry, and Carlos 5 questions each, and whoever gets the most right gets to pay for shipping.
Wait. Who gets the most wrong? Okay.
The most number of correct wrong. Sorry, yes. All right, Thierry, you are up first. Are you ready, sir?
I'm ready.
All right, question one. Heston Blumenthal's restaurant in Bray holds 3 Michelin stars, but what is the restaurant called?
Oh, the duck. Oh, my God, the duck something. Mm.
If you eat a lot of breakfast sandwiches, you'll become what?
Sick. That's for sure.
Oh my God, she can't
the
give
fat
me
duck.
Anymore.
Thank you.
Yes. Give me any more clues.
No, I was trying to remember the duck. I know it was duck something, but I was like duck.
All right, question two. Mace grows around the outside of which other spice?
Nutmeg.
That is correct. What ingredient makes a souffle rise?
Egg white.
That is also correct.
Wow,
I love
Thierry's
hearing
on a
Thierry's
roll.
On a roll. 3 for 3. Ladyfinger is a variety of which fruit?
I thought you were going to ask me a question about the cookie. I was like, yes, I know that. Ladyfingers, I'm going to go with apple.
Banana. Well, yeah. Next in the alphabet. All right. Your last question.
Wait, what have happened to avocado?
Japanese horseradish is better known as what?
Wasabi.
That is correct. All right. You got 4 out of 5 today, Thierry.
Yes.
Well done. Carlos, you're up next. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You have a solid layer of breakfast sandwiches.
Capital of Latvia.
Leopaya.
All right. Your question.
Pre.
What Swedish word is used to describe a meal with a variety of hot and cold savory dishes that you serve yourself?
smorgasbord?
That is correct.
That is a setup question.
I know.
Yeah, thanks, Mormor. That's my
We're
grandma.
We're friends.
Other side is Swedish. You didn't
Le
tell
buffet. France.
Le buffet. Le buffet.
All right. An affogato is an Italian dessert of coffee and what ingredient?
Affogato?
Mm-hmm.
Ice cream.
That is correct. Well done. Okay.
I keep getting smothered at these.
I know.
Our guests who've never played before somehow or another get 5 for 5.
It's weird. What is the main ingredient in black pudding?
Blood.
Also correct. 3 for 3. Here is your next question. What percentage of a mushroom is made out of water? 50%, 75%, or 90%?
75%?
That is actually 90.
Oh,
can you believe it? There you go. Okay.
Restraint doesn't work all the time.
I did not know this. Which country do Granny Smith apples originate from?
From Granny.
Granny Smith apples.
This is a tough one. I did not know the answer.
England?
It's actually Australia.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's,
I didn't know that
either. That's where they came from. Yeah,
it's sort of England. They're part of the crown.
Sure. Yeah. It came around.
Yeah.
All
half
right,
point maybe?
You did pretty well. 3 out of 5. Tom, you are up next.
Okay, can I wait?
Are you ready?
Yes.
What alcohol do you traditionally use to flame a Christmas pudding?
I use Everclear because I always have it around. I would say like 151 proof rum.
It's brandy.
Brandy.
Close. Not really that close.
I should have known that one. One's from the Caribbean, one is from France.
Which donut and coffee house company was founded in 1950 by
Krispy
Bill
Kreme.
Rosenberg in Quincy, Massachusetts?
Oh, Dunkin' Donuts.
That is correct. Helps. Poutine, often referred to as Canada's national dish, consists of French fries, gravy, and which other ingredient?
Cheese.
Cheese what?
Cheese cheese.
Cheese curds.
Yes.
It's still cheese.
Okay. It's the first word.
It's his show.
The other thing I would say about that is I am the only person who really isn't a poutine fan. Everyone else I know loves it, but
I actually do not like it.
I never drink that much in order to think it's good.
No, it's gross. All right. Jonah, Florida Stone, and Chesapeake Blue are all?
Crabs.
There. See, I'm giving you easy ones this week for you.
Thank you.
Such in a good mood. All right. Seattle's Chinatown International District is a total of 3, 13, or 23 acres.
3, 13, or 23. Well, are we including Little Vietnam and all the places that go down Rainier? Or
we're including
the actual district?
Seattle's Chinatown International District, according to Wikipedia.
So the ID and Chinatown together.
Yeah, I wouldn't have a clue. I'm going to go with the market is 3 acres, I believe. I'm going to go with 3, 13, and what?
23.
13.
It is 23 acres.
23 acres.
Yeah, quite large there.
Oh, it was
wonderful.
Super fun. I really enjoy losing. thank you for coming on our Tasty Trivia Challenge.
Chef Curlis.
Summer.
Selms. You'll get it. You'd like a telemarketer when I was a kid. We'd just hang up the phone if they couldn't do the last
Carlos Sum. I'm going to tell you, Maddie, will you pronounce or spell that for us so that people can look him up online?
Absolutely. K-A-R-L-I-S. And then the last name is Selms. C-E-L-M-S. Correct?
Correct.
Thank you are fantastic. Thanks for crushing us in
Thanks
trivia.
Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And Chef Terry, thank you. Congratulations on the big win.
No problem.
If you want to be part of the show, you can join the community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Radio Show. Who was our winner?
We had our winner was Karen Fagerstrom.
See, Karen joined the show, and look at her. She went away with a Rub With Love Fall
Harvest 3-pack.
Yeah. You're listening to Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by our fabulous team, Madeline Dow Pennington, Amy Richardson, sound and production by Sean McFadden. And editor is Sean, don't call me, Del Torre. Also remember, if you missed any episode of Hot Stove Society show on Cairo, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.